This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Welcome to Madinat al-Zahra. And as I mentioned earlier, that this is continuation of the Umayyad dynasty. So it's still the Umayyads. We had Abdurrahman arrive here, lay the foundations of one of the greatest civilizations the world has ever known. So if Abdurrahman the first hadn't done what he did, then we wouldn't have had Al-Andalus, and we wouldn't have had the great civilization that we do have in Spain, and also what would not have happened for the West. The Renaissance wouldn't have happened. You wouldn't have had the transfer of knowledge from Spain, Al-Andalus, from Toledo to Europe. They wouldn't have had that knowledge and they wouldn't have woken up. Not at that time anyway. So you had a direct chain of events taking place. So this was very important, Abdurrahman the First arriving here and doing what he did. You have to really understand how amazing a guy, an individual, Abdurrahman the First was. Why? Remember what happened to his family. Imagine being in his shoes. You're a young guy, he was a teenager. Your family is the superpower of the world at that time. Okay, nobody comes close. They were the superpower. The Umayyads were the superpower. And imagine everything being taken away, your whole family being wiped out, being on the run for 5 years, being the most wanted man on the face of this earth. Can you imagine the bounty on his head that the Abbasids had sent? Anybody who hands him over, gives information, ridiculous amount of bounty, ransom for him. So he's on the run, he can't trust anybody, because if he tells anybody who he is, somebody will tell the Abbasids. He witnesses his own 11-year-old brother being beheaded on the run. While they were on the run, they had to dive into the Euphrates. His brother couldn't swim, he came back and the Abbasids promised they wouldn't do anything, but in front of his own eyes, they beheaded his younger brother. He continues, makes his way to Morocco. We all heard, why did he come to Morocco? His mother's from there. Okay, he will find sanctuary, he will find help there. Now, did he do what most of us would have done? And like, you know, broken down and become depressed and everything has been taken away, the whole world is against me and that's it, like, you know, I'm angry now and I'm just gonna fade away into history. No, this 20-year-old, 21-year-old guy looked across the water from Tangiers, because you can see Al-Andalus from there, you can see Spain from there. And he says, right, that's where I'm going to go and make my destiny. And he came across, he took over control very, very quickly, took control and laid the foundations. He had to fight on three fronts. He had to fight the Christians in the north. He had to deal with the Abbasids who were trying to bring him down because they wanted to finish him off. He also had to deal with the local Muslims, the emirs that were here. Remember, there was infighting. You had all these emirs who were here carving out little kingdoms for themselves. And then all of a sudden this kid comes along and changes everything. So they want to bring him down. They want to deal with him. So he has to fight on three fronts while at the same time establishing the greatest civilization at that time. Building roads, castles, bridges, institutes, etc. Laying the infrastructure down. What an achievement. What a leader. There's many, many stories. Many, many stories about him.
How old was he roughly when he arrived in Al-Andalus?
20, 21 years old. Mm. He was 15, 16 years old when all this happened in Damascus. 5 years we know he was on the run. So when he arrived here, 20, 21 years old. Tariq ibn Ziyad was how old? 18, 19, something like that, as far as we know. How old was Muhammad ibn Qasim?
17,
18 years old. Teenagers were the driving force. Imagine Muhammad ibn Qasim, 7'11", 7'12", in Sindh, dealing with an army of 200, how many was there?
Well outnumbered.
They were well outnumbered, well outnumbered. And the Muslim army was much smaller. Tariq ibn Ziyad, we know the numbers there, 12,000 they were, 7,000 first. Reinforced with another 5,000, 12,000 against an army of 100,000, well outnumbered. These were the two front lines of Islam on both ends, on the eastern end and the western end. These are the front lines led by teenagers.
And a very quick point I want to add before I forget, because we're moving on quite fast. If you think about Abdurrahman the First's life on the run as a fugitive, you realize that he has been put through this hardship for a greater purpose. If you had seen him then when he was on the run, you would feel sorry for him. The whole world is against him. The whole world is crashing down on him, right? The Abbasid Empire is against him. Caliph Safah and then Al-Mansur, a great, powerful figure with an immense army at his disposal. He's after this one young man. They want to kill him so that there is no Umayyad threat left. So the whole world would feel sorry for him. But Allah took him through that journey, through hardship. He's running on foot, he's hiding, and then he's running, he's hiding, then he's running, he's hiding. Imagine those 4 or 5 years when he's on the run. So think about it. What is Allah preparing him for? Allah knows the future, we don't. Sometimes in life, we face challenges, and we start saying, why me, why me, why me? Oh Allah, why me, why me? But we don't know what Allah wants to do with us. We don't know what Allah plans for us in the future. Abdurrahman the First, he's the one who laid the foundations of Muslim rule in Al-Andalus. I don't think it was Tariq bin Ziyad or Musa bin Nusayr or others who came afterwards. It was Abdurrahman the First who actually laid the foundation of an organized state that continued for the next 300 years. And then, of course, afterwards we discussed what happened. So keep in mind, when hardships come, not that we look forward to them, but if Allah has chosen you for hardships, then endure, because Allah plans to do something great with you. This is the idea. Thank you. Continue.
It's okay, I'll hold it.
Oh yeah, you can hold it.
Jazakallah khair. Yes, exactly. And Abdurrahman the First, as I mentioned earlier, the bulk of our work is youth work. We work with young people. And we have a project called Deep Roots, the Muslim Youth Leadership Program. The main character in that is Abdurrahman. Because if you want to study a great leader, he's one of the greatest leaders that you can study. So Abdurrahman the First arrives, lays the foundations, and they go from strength to strength. Now remember, Abdurrahman the First arrives here with what? Nothing. What's just happened to his family? Wiped out. What's happened to the Khilafah that they had? It's taken away from them. Okay, fast forward now and you have Abdurrahman the Third. What does he have? He has everything. Does he have family now? He has huge family. Does he have a history? Does he have armies? Does he have wealth? Does he have power? And what does he do? He also reclaims the Khilafah. He's reclaiming the Khilafah. Okay, it was taken away from his ancestors. He's reclaiming it here. And also what is important is, where is he doing it? Where is he reclaiming the Khilafah? Where are we? Where is Andalus?
Western Europe.
In Europe. The very place today he's saying, oh, Islam has nothing to do with the West. Come on. There's a Khilafah here. The Khalif was based here. This is where he was based. You saw exactly the spot where he was made Khalif. You stood in the very spot where he was actually made the Khalif. So what does he do? This is a big, big event now. You know, declaring yourself as a Khalif is not a small thing. It's a major thing. You can't just go around claiming yourself Khalif. You have to do something. You have to show the world something. Okay, America wanted to show the world that they're the superpower of the world now. They wanted to make the statement. How did they do it? They bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This was a statement to the world. They didn't need to do this. Japan had been defeated. They didn't need to do this. But they actually wanted to show the world that we're not just saying it with words. We want to show you that you mess with us now, we'll wipe out whole cities. Whole cities we can wipe out now. This was a statement to the world. So what does Abdurrahman III do? He goes and bombs Saragossa, wipes it off the face of the earth. Not really, there was no bombs at that time. What does he do? He builds a brand new city. He builds a brand new city for the first time in Europe. What do I mean by that? A brand new city being built for the first time in Europe. Other cities had grown, like Rome, Athens, they'd grown from towns and villages, and as they became powerful. But for the first time, somebody came along and says, I'm going to build a brand new city. This is where the palace is going to be. This is where the masjid is going to be. This is where the administration, the sewage, the streets are going to be like this. What we call city planning, that took place here. Okay, so he builds a brand new city here. Okay, and that's what we're going to be doing. We'll stop there. We need to go inside. But we're going to go inside, see the museum, see the film, then make our way out. As I mentioned, that's where the 10% of the archaeological site is. We're going to go there, and this is as far as the bus can take us. The bus cannot take us up there. So we have to go up along there, round the back. And you see the yellow building? Then we're going to have a wander around the archaeological site and make our way back to the bus. Okay, everybody got their walking shoes?
What is that big building there?
Not really, we're not going to be walking up. There's going to be a shuttle bus which is going to take us from here and take us up there.
It's a monastery. It's a monastery.
That's an old monastery. Yeah. That's a monastery. Okay.
So, Brother Tariq has done a good introduction of what this city represents. When we get to the site, then we can look at things step by step. The documentary will highlight those developing stages of the city. And there are a few important things that we want to mention as to why Abdurrahman III did this. Okay, one of the main reasons was caliphate. 929, he declares himself to be a caliph. Now, a caliph cannot be living in a humble abode because he's now a caliph, so he has to now show splendor and a spectacle of his caliphate, or for his caliphate. So he builds a city here, and this starts in 936. It starts between 936 to 940 CE, and it continues being built well into the reign of his son, Hakam II, who ruled from 961 to 976. Okay, so he ruled for 15 years. Abdurrahman III, his reign was painfully long. How long was it? What do you think? He came to power in 912 as a very young man, and he ruled until 961. How long is this reign? About 50 years. He had a long time to do a lot of things, and he did. He was a very powerful, effective ruler, very organized, very strategic in his thinking, because he made a falling emirate into a real power. Because when he came to power, Abdurrahman III, his power was simply confined within the walls of the city of Cordoba. He didn't control much outside. And then he went out crushing rebellions. So scholars divide his reign into three parts. Okay? The first part is the expansion part, the aggressive part, where he goes out to assert his power, to take the reins of power into his own hand, defeats his enemies, rebels, invades the border territories in the north to basically show that he's the boss. He's the man who rules this territory. Okay? He will not tolerate any rebellions. So this part, it basically starts from 912 to 929 when he declares himself to be the caliph. After caliphate starts, he of course turns into a completely different monster. Now he's a caliph. He represents Islam. He's not only representing his small principality here in Cordoba or in Spain, rather he is now claiming to be Khalifatullah fil ard. Okay, he is the representative of Allah on earth. So that's why now he has to show that. So from 929 to 939, he's again on an expansion spree, right? But something crazy happens in 939 that tells him to hold on, go easy, not so fast. It was a disastrous loss. In 939, the Battle of Khandaq is called, Khandaq, okay? It's not the Battle of the Ditch the Prophet fought in Medina. It's another Battle of the Ditch where he was nearly killed in the battle. Okay, this is 939 CE. And After that day, he never personally took part in a battle because his advisors told him, Caliph, you are the Caliph. If you get killed on the battlefield, you leave us in chaos. You cannot die. You have to live. So don't, not on the front line. You're not fighting anymore. You're not on the battlefield. So he remained behind in Cordoba and he focused more on developing the state, which was again succeeded by his son, Hakam II, who became the next Caliph. So this is a short introduction of Abdurrahman III. Okay, I have his coins in my pocket. We will look at them. They were minted right here. Those coins from Madinatul Zahra were minted right here. We will look at them later on, inshallah. Let's make a move to the museum and to the documentary theater. Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We are right now in this museum. It represents Madinatul Zahra. Madinatul Zahra was named after the famous, the favorite concubine of Abdurrahman III, right? Her name was Zahra. Okay, so he named the entire city after his favorite concubine. Okay, and this city represented his power, his glory, his strength as a caliph, his wealth. So, as we will see in the documentary, we will just go into the auditorium and they will play a documentary that will show us how the city was built and why it was built. It's in Spanish. You're going to have to focus on the English subtitles, but it is absolutely mind-blowing. Okay, what we have today is 10%. Only 10% has been excavated. The rest still remains under earth. And it was only excavated recently, just about 100 years ago. This city was lost, by the way. This was a lost city. What other lost cities come to mind? Atlantis. This was the Atlantis of Al-Andalus. No one knew where Madinatul Zahra is. It's mentioned in the sources. There is so much about it, right? But no one actually had seen it. So only 100 years ago, they found some remains of it and they started to dig. And what we will see later on today are the remains of Madinatul Zahra. Are we ready for the documentary? In a few minutes? Okay. Yeah. If you want to... Yeah. Okay. Anyone who wants to look at the coins?
Can you touch it also?
Yeah, you can touch them. These are coins from the reign of Abdurrahman III. These are his coins. His name is mentioned on the coins. Please do not squeeze them. Do not drop them. Do not try to test their strength, because they're very fragile. Do not step on them, do not bite them.
You can take one away.
Yeah, they're very fragile. But the name of Abdurrahman III is mentioned there, okay? Abdurrahman, his name is mentioned there. And the mint, Madinatul Zahra, is also mentioned on the coin, okay? The mint is also mentioned, right? So these are dirhams minted right here. You can only find them with a museum, a walking museum called Adnan Rashid. Okay, right.
He's going to give one away to auntie from South Africa.
No, these are not for giving away. These are only for looking and beholding and getting inspiration.
Okay,
good. So, but these are made here. What's so amazing is that they were possibly used by someone in this city once upon a time, walking around this city, which is now under earth. Okay, so these are dirhams. Dirham is a silver coin. How did I get hold of them? This is a question. This is why I wear this hat. You know, Indiana Jones.
I go.
No, I buy them from coin dealers and different collectors. There are collectors who collect these, and there are dealers who sell them, right? So they're all legally acquired. Alhamdulillah. So there is a lot of information on them, by the way, but we cannot read them at this point, at this moment. Okay. So this is Madinatul Zahra. We're gonna now make our way, and we will continue with the vlog later on once we get to the Madinatul Zahra, inshallah. Thank you so much.
We are in a very important defining moment in the history of Al-Andalus. And again, as I keep saying, there's lots of lessons for us, but it's a defining moment in the point, because we started with Tariq ibn Ziyad conquering, Abdurrahman arrives, lays the foundations of Al-Andalus, the civilization that was to come. They go from strength to strength to strength. And this is the peak. This is the high point of the Islamic civilization here. Okay, so what is the defining moment? Is the building of Madinat al-Zahra. At this moment, Al-Andalus is so powerful, so powerful, that there is actually a Khalif based here. We have a Khilafah here now. Okay, the Khalif, he had a throne room. Dignitaries were coming from all over the world, including big parts of Europe as well. You saw in the film how many kings from and dignitaries from Europe were coming here to pay homage, to show loyalty, to get favors from the Khalif based here in Al-Andalus, to Abdurrahman III. So when we talk about the Khilafah, we don't just mean Al-Andalus. Big chunk of North Africa was part of Al-Andalus at that time, and many countries in Europe, including places like Switzerland, etc., they were paying jizya to Abdurrahman III here. Okay, we have evidence of this, we have proof of this, that they were paying jizya at that time. So when you pay jizya, generally speaking, that's part of your empire, basically. So big chunks of Europe were part of the Khilafah of Al-Andalus at that time. So why is this a defining moment? It's a defining moment because of the deep lesson. So when you reach a peak, what happens after that?
You have to come down.
The only way is down. So now things are going to start falling apart. And what happens is you have Abdurrahman, he passes away, Al-Hakam, his son takes over after him. He leaves behind an heir who's just a bit of a nobody. Well, he's very, very young. He's very young. So he can't really run a huge empire like this. So who really takes over is Al-Mansur. Who was Al-Mansur? Who remembers? Who was Al-Mansur? But what have we discussed about him so far? What did he do? Sorry? He was the? Yes. But what we've discussed so far, where do you remember him from?
He fought from some mountain.
They don't remember. I'm leaving. They weren't. No.
It's okay.
Yesterday,
punishment,
you remember.
Punishment. Prescribe the punishment.
Dinner tonight is on who?
No. Put monetary fine. They will remember all the details.
Okay. So, remember the fourth extension to Masjid al-Qurtuba? The fourth extension where he paid the old lady and he was buying houses and that. He was the emir. Okay? He takes over now. He started from humble beginnings, but he made his way all the way up to the top and became the prime minister. In the West, he's hated. Okay? They were petrified of this guy. Absolutely petrified. Because every time there was a change of rulership here, obviously the Christians in the North were always trying to make inroads into Al-Andalus. And when there's a change of power, there's instability. And this is a good time to take over if you're going to take over somewhere. So what Al-Mansur would do is every year he would run campaigns into the north and put the Christians in their place to say, right, don't mess, like, you know, don't even think about trying to do anything with Al-Andalus. The other point about him was that the Muslim battle cry is what?
Allahu Akbar.
Allahu Akbar. So what the Christians started to do was, you know, in Christianity there's a lot of, like, you know, relics and things like this, because it's a control system, okay? So to get people to follow you, you say, oh, somebody saw the Virgin Mary over there. Somebody saw a certain saint over there. We found this. This is a piece of the true cross of that. And that brings people and, you know, emotions and things like that. And they use that to drive Christianity. So in one battle, they discovered the bones of Santiago, Saint James, who was one of the disciples of Jesus. There's no proof, evidence that he ever came to Spain. Nobody ever knows of any story where he actually came to Spain. But the church used that and they said, oh, because Santiago, there was one battle which the Christians won. It says, oh, because Santiago was there, he helped you win this battle. So the Christian battle cry became Santiago. And he became the patron saint of Spain. And today, I'll send a photo later on in the group, but even in the mosque and around Spain, there's statues of Santiago. Okay, he's sitting on a horse, and the horse has got his hooves raised up, and they're trampling a Muslim underneath. He's given the title Santiago Matamora, the Moor Slayer, the killer of Moors. And that became their battle cry. And there, in the north, is Santiago de Compostela. the biggest pilgrimage in Christianity today, the biggest pilgrimage in Christianity is to Santiago de Compostela. People come from all over the world and they go walking for hundreds of miles for days and make a pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela. Even today, every year this happens. It's the biggest pilgrimage in the world, not to Jerusalem, to Santiago. Okay?
So
what
it
did
it's in Madrid?
In the north.
Northwest.
Okay? So what did Al-Mansur do? Al-Mansur used to do battles every year, used to go campaign. He went and sacked Santiago de Compostela. He sacked it. The bells from there, from the monastery, he made Christians carry them, bring them to Cordoba, and he turned them into lamps to decorate Masjid Cordoba. Okay? But he didn't touch the priests. You know, we have the saying that the priests and monks in Islam, there's a commandment that don't touch them, leave them alone. And that's why he said to his soldiers, he said, don't touch them.
And just to quickly add, what are those 10 commandments? Not 10 commandments of Moses, but 10 rules or regulations a Muslim army or Muslim generals must obey and abide by. Let's cut it short. Do not kill women, do not kill children, do not kill elderly, do not cut trees, do not kill animals unless you're eating them, do not kill monks who are in the monasteries. That's a very important clause. And this comes directly from the companions of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, when he was sending this expedition to Syria, led by Yazid bin Abi Sufyan. Yazid bin Abi Sufyan was the elder brother of Muawiyah radiallahu anhu. When he was sent on an expedition by Abu Bakr, these 10 instructions were given, and they can be found in Kitab al-Jihad of Mu'atta of Imam Malik. So these guys are what? They are already Malikis. They are Malikis. So nothing could be higher for them in authority than Imam Malik's Mu'atta, which is very popular. So they abided by those rules. Thank you. Continue.
Jazakallah khair for that. So Al-Mansur, he went and sacked that to show them you are praising Santiago, but Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater. And then also, as mentioned yesterday, Al-Mansur, it's said that he used to carry a handwritten Quran, which he apparently wrote himself, everywhere he went. And then when he used to come back from the battles, he would ask his servants to shake the dust off his clothes and gather the dust. And then he left in his will that when I die, bury me with this dust. So on the day of judgment, when my hisab is done, this bears witness how much I fought in the way of Allah. He also built another wonder city. This is called Madinat al. He built Madinat al-Zahira, another city which was further down, completely ruined. Now, Al-Mansur, he came from nowhere. He's not nobility, he's not royalty, he's not nothing like that, okay? So he needs to protect himself, okay? How does he protect himself? How do you protect yourself if you're nobody, if you don't have any ancestry, lineage, etc.? And
friends
can be disloyal as well, but otherwise...
Marry into royalty or...
You can marry, but also... You buy
loyalty.
Mercenaries. So he had a mercenary army which was Berbers. Okay? And what happened is the mistake Al-Mansur made was when he was dying, he tried to place one of his sons as the new Khalif. Remember, he didn't declare himself Khalif. He declared himself Amir. But when he tried to put his son, now what's he doing? He's directly challenging who? The Umayyads. He's directly challenging them. Are the Umayyads going to be happy?
No.
Of course, they knew Al-Mansur is running things, but officially he is not the Khalif. Okay, he's the Amir, right? Okay, everybody lives with it. Fine. But now if you officially say in your face that, okay, no, we're going to become the Khalifs now. So what happened is civil war. Civil war amongst the Muslims. Okay, this wasn't destroyed by Christians. This was destroyed by Muslims. The Library of Cordoba wasn't destroyed by Christians. It was destroyed by Muslims. Cordoba wasn't sacked by Christians, it was sacked by Muslims. Because the Berber army, the mercenaries, they're loyal to. And when they realize that, okay, there's a civil war going on here, maybe our guy is going to lose, our paymaster may be gone, so what should we do? Let's just grab what we can. So they started to loot and pillage and take whatever they could, and then they went wherever. And then what happened, this is why this is a defining moment, is Al-Andalus breaks up into lots of petty kingdoms known as Molokul Tawaifs. Okay? Petty kingdoms with petty rulers. each competing with one another, against one another, turning to the Christians to come and help us to defeat my next door neighbor. And then after a little while, the Christians will take over my kingdom and your kingdom and start carrying on one by one. So this is a defining moment, because what happens is this is where the downfall begins now. Okay, from this, it's just downhill. One by one, the Christian kingdoms are being taken. But then we had the two revivals by Murabitun and then the Wahidun. These were the two revivals. But then after that, no more revivals. And we will carry on to Granada to see how the final fall happened and the end happened. So why is this a defining moment, and what lesson do we have to take from this? Okay, this, you remember right at the beginning, is the blueprint. The blueprint, Al-Andalus, is the blueprint for what? For colonialism, occupation, etc., etc., that we see that's went on around the world. This is the blueprint for it. How is it the blueprint? So if today you want to know, how do you defeat Islam and Muslims? Okay, do we have an example in history? We have 1400 years of Islamic history now. That's a long time. Okay, so do we have an example in history where this has happened, where we've been able, completely been able to deal with them or wipe them out? Or so you look at all of Islamic history, where's the only place where this took place? No, brother, come on. Al-Andalus, exactly where we are.
We need to find some people.
Yeah. I know people that
we need to make examples. We need to make examples.
Yes. So, Al-Andalus is the only place. Okay, so let's study this now. Let's study Al-Andalus. What happened? From this point to this point, couldn't touch them. Too powerful, too strong. So what was going on from here to here? Ah, okay, they had one leader. Initially an emir, and then a khalif. But in whichever context, there was one leader, and the whole entity was united as one. When were we able to start taking land and empire from them? So at this point, from this point, what was going on at this point? Ah, they were all divided. They were chopped up into Mulukul Tawaifs. So how do we take that blueprint and apply it globally now? Okay, this is an example. How do we apply it globally? What did we have until 1922? In principle, whether it was functioning, Khilafah. Okay, whether it was working or whatever it was, but from the time of the Prophet ﷺ until now, we had the institute. What happened to the institute of the Khilafah? It was dismantled. Officially dismantled by who?
British
and?
French.
And the French. Yeah. And this was called what? The chopping up of the Ottoman Empire was known as the?
Sykes-Picot Agreement.
The chopping up. So after that, the Muslim nation, which was one in name initially, became what? Became Mulukul Tawaifs. Nation states became Mulukul Tawaifs, with petty rulers competing with one another, turning to foreign powers to help them deal with their fellow. Exactly the same. This is a blueprint. This is a recipe.
Same thing happened in India.
Same thing happening in India. Same thing happening in other places. So if others have studied this history, learned from this history, applying this history, what should we as Muslims be doing? We should also be learning from this, because it's only when you learn from history that you can recognize what is happening today. And it's only when you recognize what is happening today that you can do something about it. Remember, I gave the example that if on this tour I'm going along every day taking something from you, and you don't even realize, I'll be successful. But if you wake up, you realize I've taken something, and you tell everybody else, what are you going to do?
Beat me up.
But more than that, you will make sure that I'm not able to do it. You will defend it. And you will recognize what moves I make, that, oh, okay, he does it like this, or he does it like that. You recognize how he did it. Just like that now today, that if we don't look at history and we don't understand what is happening, you won't recognize what is happening today. So if you don't recognize what is happening today, how are you going to do anything about it? You'll carry on blindly and just think that, oh, it's happening, it's just random, it's just a coincidence. No, it's not a coincidence. Okay, so this is a very, very important defining moment in the history. A lot of lessons, we will talk more about it later on. But just remember where we are in the timeline. And then after this, the Mulukul Tawaifs, then the two revivals which we've already seen in Seville. But then after this we're following the chronology. Remember, we're following the chronology. After this, we're going to go where now? To Granada. Granada held out for 200 years. We're going to see what happened in Granada, how it fell, why it fell. And then finally, on Friday, we will go into the Alpujarra Mountains, where the remnants of the Muslims that were left here, the Moriscos who were forced to convert to Christianity, where they ended up and how they were wiped out, how they were ethnically cleansed. Okay, so that's the timeline that we are following. That's where we are in the history. You want to add or you want to carry on?
Yeah, just very quickly, I want to add to the personalities, you know, just to focus on the personalities a bit more. Abdurrahman III is the person responsible for building this city, or this city-state, you can call it. It's like an estate, which is a giant project. Okay, he started it in 936 CE, about, you can say, 7 years after he declared himself to be the caliph in the West. Okay, why he did that is a long story. Scholars have talked about it. He was basically trying to assert his Islamic right as he saw it, because the Fatimids were rising in North Africa. In Egypt, the Fatimid Caliphate, the Shia Fatimid Caliphate, was taking territory in North Africa. They were coming westwards. So Abdurrahman III had to reassert his claim to caliphate, the initial Umayyad claim, because he was a direct descendant of the Umayyads, yes. Banu Umayyah, right? Direct line. So he reasserted it to be able to save his domain in Al-Andalus and also North Africa. So he raided North Africa and he took territory from the Fatimids to stop them. Okay, this he did with this goal in mind, because the Abbasids now have lost power. By this time, the Abbasids in Baghdad are already in sharp decline. Right, by the 9th century or by the 10th century, the Abbasids are already falling. Right, so he knew the Abbasids are not able to do anything about the Fatimids. So he had to do something, and he said, "Okay, I am the Caliph. I have the bloodline. I have the claim. I'm Qurayshi. I'm Umayyad, and I'm claiming to be the Caliph." Okay, and this was a very strategic move on his part. Okay, because once you become a Caliph, then you become an Islamic authority. Right. Then you have to be obeyed by the Muslims in the land, right? So those who are fighting you, those who are rebelling against you from petty kingdoms or petty towns or petty principalities, let's say, they now become traitors to Islam. You see what's happening here? They become now so this was a very genius move on his part. In order to unite the Muslims around his personality and around his entity, he did this, right? And this is why he became what he became. Abdurrahman III, the most powerful man. An-Nasir. Okay, his title was An-Nasir. Okay, the one who does Nusra for the deen of Allah. Right? So he claimed this highly religious, highly charged title for himself. And this is why he built the city, Madinat al-Zahra, so that he can show his splendor, his power, his glory. And the spectacle, when all those northern Christian kingdoms send their ambassadors from, let's say, France and Britain and Germany, they are coming, as you saw in the documentary, they are walking in and they are being blown away. Because for kilometers, many kilometers, what do you see on the road? You see soldiers. Okay? They are called Sakaliba. Okay, Sakaliba, these are Slavic, Eastern European slaves bought from slave markets, because at this time Europeans started to invade. When I say Europeans, Western Europeans started to invade Eastern Europe, and they bought many slaves from there. When they would invade territories, they would capture people, and then they would be sold in slave markets. There would be Jewish merchants who would buy them and who would bring them to Al-Andalus and sell them, and the Caliph would buy these slaves, and this became a huge contingent. Actually, he depended on these slaves military slaves who became very powerful, very influential, very educated, to the extent that the Umayyads started to go into decline. The Umayyad families, because there were too many intrigues, the caliph wanted die-hard loyal followers, loyalists like his sons. You know, so these slaves were bought by the caliph. The caliph was directly owning them. They were like his sons. They would defend the caliph with their lives because they had no loyalties. They had lost their families back home. They were now slaves. So the caliph was the father. This is why Jafar, the man, who is Jafar? Who is Jafar?
The eunuch.
Who was he? The what? His title? Finds. We have to find. Okay. So, Jafar is the man who is mentioned on the arch in Masjid Qartaba. Remember the name Jafar? Yes. After the caliph's name. What was the name of the caliph? Al-Hakam. Al-Hakam. And immediately after Al-Hakam's name is Jafar, who is Hajib, who is the prime minister. Okay. And he was from the Saqaliba. He was from that back. He was a eunuch, right? Eunuchs are castrated slaves who are used for specific reasons. And they became so powerful. Some of them became wazirs and generals and administrators. So the caliphs depended on them because they didn't fear rebellion from them. They would not succeed because they didn't have any clans backing them, like the Berbers, like the Arabs, or like the Syrians and the Yemenis. Too many problems. So the caliphs, they decided, to hell with these clans, I'm going to make my own army who are going to be my die-hard followers. Same thing happens with Al-Hakam II. Now, very quickly, I want to move forward because we're taking too much time here. Al-Hakam was also ruling from here. He ruled from 961 to 976. He built one of the largest libraries in the world at the time. 400,000 volumes, 400,000 handwritten manuscripts in his library. This was unprecedented in the history of the world. Never before such a large number of books, including the library of the famous library of Baghdad and Alexandria. Baghdad, I cannot say. Baghdad,
probably bigger.
But when I say in the world, he had created something, 40 volumes alone, folios, 40 folios were just the catalog. Just the catalog. He had female scribes, scholars, transcribing manuscripts from him, for him. He had specifically sent agents around the world, in the eastern part of the Muslim world, Baghdad, Damascus, Samarkand, Bukhara. He would send agents to go and buy, just buying books, nothing else. Just buying books for him to bring those books back to his library and so that they can be transcribed or copied and put into his library. Unfortunately, all of that was destroyed here. When in 1013, when was the city started? This one? 936. In 1013, the Berbers, the army, as mentioned by Brother Tariq, they came in and they destroyed the city. And with the city went the library up in flames, unfortunately, right? One of the greatest treasures of Islam, we don't know what we lost there. All the books on philosophy, poetry, literature, tafsir, and hadith and Quran manuscripts possibly coming from the time of the prophet or companion, all of that went up in flames, unfortunately. Two or three catastrophes we must not forget in our history. I'll mention them one by one. That library lost here in Madinat al-Zahra, okay? The second library was when Baghdad was sacked by the Mongols in 1258. They destroyed the library of Baghdad. We don't know what we lost there. And the third destruction was in Granada in 1492. Over 1 million books were collected by the Catholic priests and monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella. They were put to fire in a square that we will see, inshallah, we will visit, right? These catastrophes, unfortunately, are irreversible. We don't know what we lost there. On that note, we'll stop there. Again, Ibn Abi Amir was also a very important figure here related to Madinat al-Zahra. Three figures, Abdurrahman III, Hakam II, and Ibn Abi Amir al-Mansur. Okay, al-Mansur. His name is Ibn Abi Amir, also known as al-Mansur. He was also very active here. So let's go, inshallah. We will start moving down there. And then we have some time. We're going to look at the ruins and then come back.
We have a very good view of the ruins. This is Madinatul Zahra. Only 10% of it has been excavated. What you see down there in the valley, pretty much the rest of the city is under those fields. It could be very far. We still don't have any idea as to how much is actually buried there. Okay, but this part with the roofs, you can see with the triangular roofs, this is the great hall, the audience hall where the caliph would receive dignitaries and ambassadors to basically give them a sense of awe. Okay, because this was lavishly decorated. Unfortunately, it's locked for the past few years because they're doing renovations in there, but it's an absolutely amazing sight to see. So you can, where you're standing right now could easily be royal quarters, okay? Caliph's favorite wives and concubines living in these quarters, and the royal family, cousins and aunts, and maybe people from the royal family, and the wazir also would be living somewhere close by. The details are far too many for us to discuss right now, so let's keep moving, inshallah, okay? Yeah, the cameraman is back, so just try to have an idea of the magnificence of this city when it was newly built. It would be so awesome and so amazing that anyone who came here, people who have actually visited the city, they have described it, that there's nothing like it in the world. There was a nun, a German nun, who came to Cordoba in the 10th century. Her name was Hrosvita, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, because that's how the word is written in the English language. She described the city of Cordoba and what she saw here around the city as the ornament of the world. Okay, the ornament of the world. Obviously, she was directly inspired by what she saw here. So now we are walking in the streets, or in the pathways where only the royalty would walk. An ordinary person from Cordoba, a Muslim or a non-Muslim, could never make to this place. They were not allowed to come here. Sorry, can we? Yeah. No worries. Thank you. Thank you so much. So this is strictly for the royalty. This, where you're walking right now, easily the royal family, their servants, the chosen servants, high-ranking eunuchs, and slaves and slave girls, they would be serving in these quarters, right? And some of these slaves who were part of the royal household, they would become so influential and so powerful that they would even challenge people who would have royal bloodline, right? Like the Umayyads. So these slaves were very, very powerful. They were not slaves anymore. We have so many examples in the history of Islam where slaves became kings and sultans. For example, what is the famous dynasty? There is a dynasty called the slave dynasty. Where was it? The Mamluks of where? Egypt. The Mamluks of Egypt. The word Mamluks literally means slaves. Slave kings. And Mamluks basically took power from the Ayyubids. When the Ayyubids had become weak politically, the Mamluks, who were the slaves of the Ayyubids, they took power from the Ayyubids, and they ruled from around 1250 CE to 1517, when the Ottomans, Sultan Salim, defeated the Mamluks and took the land of Hijaz and Egypt from the Mamluks. But there was another slave dynasty.
Seljuk. No.
Okay. Very often belittled and not appreciated as much as the Mamluks of Egypt, but they were no less powerful. Where is this second slave dynasty?
In
India. The Mamluk dynasty of India, where slaves, Turkic slaves, became so powerful that they created this dynasty called the Delhi Sultanate, right? Mm-hmm. That lasted from the year around 1200 to 1526, when Zahiruddin Babur, the first Mughal emperor, came from Central Asia and he took this land. Now, look at this. This is absolutely amazing. This is a structure standing to this day. Obviously, it has been renovated. There are still remnants from the time. You can still see So this building housed the main state administrative offices. This building must have been the headquarters of one of the Caliphal administration departments. Materials and decoration were simple. Okay, so this is like an administrative building. But look at the magnificence of this building. And there are still signs from the Muslim period. Okay. If you read here on the capital, right? These are pillars, columns. If you zoom in, if you can, you can show. Okay, no. It says Amal. Amal Yad. Okay. This is the work of the hand. I cannot read the name. I cannot make out what the name is. But there's a name of someone. It says Amal Yad. This is made by the hand of such and such person. So you can see the name there, right? So this is a capital carved by a Muslim worker, engineer, or architect, or a laborer. But think about it. Where does the design come from? The Romans. Abdurrahman the First, when he built Qartaba Masjid, these capitals were taken from a Roman site. But this is a copy of the Roman capitals, okay? And they've done an amazing job, as you can see, right? So this design actually inspired from Roman architecture. So the Muslims, so this was an administrative building. This was some sort of administrative compound where caliphs, possibly Jafar the eunuch, who was the hajib or the prime minister or the finance minister, he was possibly working here with his staff, and he had a lot of work to do. And you saw his name inscribed or put by mosaic work on the mihrab in Masjid Qartaba. He was a very important figure. He was a eunuch. He was from the Saqaliba. He was Slavic, possibly, originally, from Eastern Europe, but became so powerful that his name is on the mihrab. And you see that mosaic work, the verses of the Quran on top of the mihrab, those workers actually came from Byzantium, from Constantinople. We know there were embassies being exchanged between Caliph Abdurrahman III and the Byzantines, the Romans. They were sending embassies, and he was also sending embassies. So let's keep moving, inshallah. So some of the workers who knew how to do mosaics, they did that work in Qartaba Masjid. Let's go. Keep moving, inshallah. Are there any questions so far? Any questions? Keep moving together, brothers. Yeah.
The Muslim castrate him, or was he castrated before?
He was castrated before.
So Muslims, they don't castrate?
No. Muslims are not allowed to castrate slaves. This is completely haram. This is not allowed. Okay. So unfortunately, these slaves were already castrated before they arrived in slave markets. Yeah. Okay. And why they were castrated is a very good question. There were a number of reasons why they were castrated. Okay. Usually eunuchs would be used for the women's quarter, you know, the harem. Okay, so this is to avoid fitna. So if it's a eunuch, obviously he is safer than men to have in the harem, basically, right?
So is it halal to buy slaves from
these are very good questions. Historically, all dynasties, all kingdoms at that time were buying slaves, okay, for a number of different reasons. Yeah. So everyone was buying
because
slaves.
Non-Muslims, what they can do is they can go raid, you know, an innocent village.
Obviously, and this was out of their control. But when these Muslim kings from Spain in particular were buying slaves, they were buying them to give them high positions in the state apparatus, because they didn't fear any rebellions from them. You understand? If they had put Arabs and Berbers in high positions, they always feared rebellions and intrigues. So this is why they bought these slaves. They would belong as a property to the caliph, and the caliph would put them in high positions because caliph could trust them blindly. They could not easily betray the caliphs and the kings and the sultans. Okay, so this is a very important place. As you can see, when you Google Madinat al-Zahra, this is one of the places that comes in front of you. If we can show, inshallah, these arches,
the compound,
the palace compound, or the palaces or the houses of the royalty, and the actual how they looked at the time, we can only imagine. If they look like this today, you can imagine what the full building, the complete building, would have looked like, or the compound. Unfortunately, the ruins for the last 1,000 years, okay, people over time were taking blocks and building materials from here. There was a lot of plundering and vandalism and looting, and obviously then it was buried under dust. 1,000 years is a long time, okay? So, but still, for this to survive and to have been excavated, this is absolutely mind-blowing. Look at those bricks and those walls. This was built very powerfully. Very strong foundations were put. Even after 1,000 years, having been plundered and vandalized and destroyed systematically, the site, the foundations still stand. Let's go. Keep moving because it's very hot, inshallah. So I want to very quickly mention that we do these tours every few months, every few weeks. Anyone who wants to join us on these tours, you can go on halalgetaways.com and check out the future dates. We are doing Spain and Turkey, right? And we will be doing Morocco in October as well. And people with us, they don't care about these dates anymore because they're already here, okay? But those of you who want to join us, you are most welcome to join us, inshallah, on the future dates. Right. So we're gonna go around, guys. I wish we could stay here for longer, but our time is very limited. It's very hot. We don't want casualties. So if you look from here, from this side, it gives an idea of what this complex would have looked like. And this would have been the most powerful, the strongest complex, because this is the royal quarter. I have no doubt that this was one of the most important parts of the city. Maybe library, the caliph's library was held here. Maybe the administration was being taken care of. But this is the royal part of Madinat al-Zahra, and the city would go down into the fields all the way. It's still not fully discovered or excavated. We hope sometime in the future this can be done. Now, some of these places still remain. The reason they have blocked these places, because people come and vandalize, they start inscribing their names, like if someone came here with their girlfriend, they would just put the name with the heart with the woman, or maybe someone with the wife or something, you know. So as you know, if you go to India and Pakistan to some historic sites, you see inscriptions, graffitis all over the place. And as you might have seen in Al-Khazar as well, you saw the graffitis, right? This was before they started to take it seriously. And Alhambra Palace, unfortunately, is the same situation. You see a lot of graffitis on places because people, I don't know why they would inscribe their names on. Who cares you're here with your girlfriend? Who cares? You just go, you know. Why are you destroying history just because you have your girlfriend with you? Or
Right? Leave him in like a month.
Yeah. Right? So history is our collective human heritage. Historic sites must be protected. They must be studied and looked at. In fact, we as Muslims, we have been told to study history very carefully. 30% of the Quran is history. 30%. Why? Because we take lessons. Okay. Can someone please tell the brothers and sisters behind us to be quick, inshallah. Okay, we can take some rest here very quickly. This is the great hall. You can see the roof. And
which we are showing from the top, right?
We saw the great hall from top. These are the roofs. Okay, underneath is the great hall, the audience hall of the caliph, where he would demonstrate his political power to ambassadors and dignitaries who would visit him for political reasons, to pay homage, to pay taxes. You know, Abdurrahman III was so powerful that kings would send gifts and presents to him from distant lands. He had people ruling parts of Switzerland. Muslims ruled, did you know that?
No.
Muslims ruled parts of Switzerland.
No.
Muslims were ruling parts of Switzerland. And they were there at the time of Abdurrahman III. Abdurrahman III, he would receive a lot of gifts, a lot of submissions. For example, people want to submit to his power. He was very powerful. He had made a name for himself because of his campaigns. He had consolidated the power here. And there was a lot happening here. At that time, scholars were flocking to Cordoba. Many political, important dignitaries, they were coming here. So he would receive them in this hall. Okay, and when they would walk into the hall was lavishly, richly decorated, and people would be immediately blown away by the splendor, by the magnificence of the hall.
The roof tiles, are they later on?
Yeah, the roof tiles are later, by the way. These are later renovations.
But the white wall?
No, not even the white wall. No. There is original stuff inside, okay? All of this is later. The Spanish government did to protect the original. But you can, when you go in, when you can, you will see signs of fire, you know, because all of this was burnt down by the Berber rebels who had rebelled, and they destroyed Madinat al-Zahra, unfortunately. No, I haven't seen it inside, unfortunately, because it's been closed for many years. They are carrying out renovations. So, here I want to very quickly end the vlog here. I don't want to make it painfully long because I think people who are watching online, they have a fair idea now what the city looks like today and what it might have looked like in the past. We can only imagine. We can never get 100% accurate picture. So this city complex was called Madinat al-Zahra, was built in 936 by Abdurrahman III, the most powerful man ruling Western Europe, the most powerful king in Western Europe by all measures, right? His prime minister was a Jewish man, not the prime minister, so his treasure minister or his finance minister was a Jewish physician called Hazdai ibn Shaprut. So this is how powerful the Jewish people had become under his rule and during his reign. And this is why Jewish scholars state that this was the golden age of the House of Israel. From the year 900 to 1200, this was the golden age. 300 years the Jews went through a revival of Jewish religion and Jewish intellectual activism, and the Hebrew language was revived based upon Arabic grammatical model. So on that note, thank you so much everyone watching on live. Next you will see us in Granada checking out Alhambra or somewhere else, inshallah. Until then, assalamu alaikum. We have changed, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, we have changed our mind. We wanted to show you more of Madinat al-Zahra. If you look at this part, okay. Everyone, if you can move this way, yep, you're going to take pictures, no problem. Okay, look at this compound. This is so beautiful. Again, I must emphasize, these are royal quarters. We don't know for sure who exactly lived here. We can only guess by looking at the quality of architecture and the amount of work that's gone into this this compound, the foundations and the walls and the decoration on the arches. Okay, a lot of this has been renovated recently because this was all destroyed and it was on the floor. It was buried under rubble. It was taken out and resurrected again thanks to the Spanish government and archaeologists who have worked hard unearthing. Yeah, so let's keep walking. So you can only imagine now. what it might have looked like at the time. Okay, so if you look there, you see that? Now, I can only imagine what might have been housed in that building under those arches or behind those arches, but it was definitely royal quarters. Something royal, something important was happening here. These are all royal buildings, maybe a library, maybe a masjid, maybe a resting place, maybe caliph's, his own room, his own living compound. It could be anything. Keep moving, let's go. Now we can look down there. There are maybe rooms or dungeons or basements for whatever reason, possibly escape route or something like that. Allahu alam, Allah knows best. Let's keep moving, everyone. Let's keep moving. Let's stay together. Time is up. Okay. If you remember the documentary, they showed a pond, right? Yeah, that pond, it would have been here, right? And again, it's only a guess. It is assumed that Jafar lived here. This was Jafar's quarter. Jafar, the eunuch, the Hajib, or the prime minister, or the finance minister. Because Hajib was a comprehensive title and a comprehensive duty, responsibility. Hajib was like a prime minister, someone who received delegations, basically the private secretary, the action man of the caliph. And this person would be executing. You know, he would be the executive representative of the caliph. The caliph doesn't get involved in the nitty-gritties and all the signing of papers and documents and checking the finances. He chooses a trustworthy guy, a trustworthy person, he can fully trust, okay? And then he gives these responsibilities to that person and he executes everything. This is, in some cases, a more powerful person, a more powerful figure than the caliph himself. He can move and shake things, right? So Jafar might have lived here in these quarters. If you look at the arches and the rooms, this is Madinat al-Zahra. Amazing, absolutely amazing. Let's go, keep going. Let's go. Huh? Do you notice a change in my energy when the camera turns on?
Yes, yes, yes. You speak so loud.
So you guys need to keep your cameras on. So we might be walking inside the rooms of the caliph or his favorite wife or one of the wives of, you know, maybe a prince or something, you know, who, unfortunately, there is no narrative, there is no history that describes the details of the court, because this was a very private area. This is very private. This is royal palace. Like, it's like going to Saudi Arabia or Dubai or, you know, one of those kings and rulers of the Gulf states. You don't know anything about the private quarters. Not that we want to know, but, you know. Yeah. Very quickly now, because time is up. Again, there are some descriptions. There are archaeologists. This is where the prime minister's servants lived and worked. Okay. Amazing. This is where Jafar, the prime minister, his servants lived and worked. Again, I don't know how they assumed this, but there must be a reason. Look. The color, the paint from the original walls, still, it's there. I don't know if this was the original color, but this is what, maybe this is what the color was of the wall. But so over time, color changes, as you know, it fades, right? So let's keep moving, inshallah. Yeah, we are now getting out. We're heading out, actually, right? It's a very richly built, detailed living quarters. This is an oven, everyone. This is an oven. right? Okay, this is an oven where they would cook bread.
I think we should go up and go around or something, you know?
Right? So this is the tandoor. This is where you get your chicken tikka, tandoori naan with butter and all that. Okay. I can only imagine. Well, clearly the best food in Al-Andalus would be cooked here in this quarter, because this is Caliph and his royal household, the family, right? This is where the best food would be cooked. So now, where are we? We are now heading out towards the exit, because we have to catch the bus, next bus. Guards quarters, okay. Again, guards were kept here. Again, this is where the servants and the guards would be kept. There are so many passages and secret chambers and dungeons and...
And this is just one big building.
It was all interconnected. Okay. It was all maybe there were different roofs, housing different quarters. But this was all interconnected. This is clearly the establishment. This is where the establishment was. Caliph's household, his administration, and his vizier. So on that note, I think this is enough. From Madinatul Zahra, and inshallah more to come. Assalamu alaikum, everyone.